So this is lesson 8. We're on chapter 8. And hopefully for those who are not here, they'll listen to this and know that they need to do 2 lessons next week, both 9 and 10. So they will be prepared as well.
There's no question today.
What we did was kind of the question and kind of discussing why we used those specific measurements. And we will get back to it as we get in the later part of the lesson. So the end part of this lesson is the most important. So I probably will try to be flying so that we get to the end, and particularly before anybody needs to leave. So just hold on there till the end, where I think is the whole gist of where he's going with this. So, well, we've been talking about Jesus being the high priest, and Jesus being a better high priest than the Levitical high priests. And now he goes into the fact that not only is Jesus the better high priest, but he has a better covenant from which he ministers from. That's the whole gist of 8. So you begin to wonder, and then of course then next week he has a better tabernacle and he has a better sacrifice. Why does he have to keep on pounding at evidence that Jesus is better? You would think, from where we stand, come on, don't you know that Jesus is better? Of course he's better. But remember, and I think this is just as applicable for us, remember that they have inundated themselves with the Levitical system. And the Levitical system is a very transactional system. It's not only how their religion works, but it's how the world works. And they're so inundated with it that for the Hebrew writer to say, well, but Jesus is better, just like us, we can say, oh yeah, we know Jesus is better. But how many of you then have completely left your transactional living? Right? I mean, we say, yes, we know Jesus is better. His way is so much better. And then we're like, you know, an hour later, we're right back into the transactional living. And this is the same way here. The difference being that their religious system was so transactional. And of course, ours is not. Is that true?
Yeah,
no, see, ours is the same. So it is the Hebrew writer giving more and more evidence because he's bringing them along, trying to show them, yeah, I know that this is what you do, but this is not giving you life. So he continues to give them evidence upon evidence about how much better it is that what Jesus is giving us, where he's coming from, where he's living, what he has offered to us. So that's why we're going to continue to go. I mean, it's going to be better priesthood, better covenant, better tabernacle, better sacrifice, over and over and over again, so that we get more and more head understanding, but also hopefully we begin to have eyes that see more and more how much better it is. So that's why he continues to go into this. So he says that Jesus is a better high priest. We've already gone through that, but I'm going to go just really quickly through that, because from 7 to 8, it's kind of just flows right in. There's not a real good break there. But a better priest then requires a better everything. So he's first told us that he is a better or superior priest. In 7, he told us that his priesthood, the kind of priesthood he had, which was a Melchizedek priesthood, was superior to the Levitical priesthoods. First of all, in his adequacy, this priest, Jesus, was much more adequate than the Levitical priests. And this is really just a very quick summary there. Basically, because he was exactly what we needed. The Levitical priests weren't exactly what we needed. They were not whole themselves, and so could not give us their wholeness. Not only was Jesus as a priest completely whole, completely connected to God, never having been unconnected, he was also willing to identify in our brokenness. So he was the one person that was able to hold those two in tension and be okay with it. He was able to be completely whole and hold our brokenness at the same time. How well do we do that? How well do we live in tension? We don't like that, do we? We don't like two things to be true that are opposites. That's very difficult, particularly for the Western mind, very difficult to hold for us. How can one thing be black and white? That's just really hard. And yet Christ could do that because he was whole and wasn't losing anything when he held on to our brokenness as well. That was chapter 7. Jesus is superior in his work as well because his work was accomplished. It accomplished everything effectively. The Levitical priest's work was not effective. It was okay for the moment, but then the next day they had to do it again and do it again and do it again. Whereas Christ's work is completely effective, able to bring wholeness. Now, all of these we will go into depth in the next couple chapters. So now we get into 8:1. So looking at 8:1, it says, now the main point in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest, a priest who is adequate, who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. So in his work, not only was it able to accomplish what he wanted, it was finished. It was accomplished. And that's whenever we see him being portrayed as being seated. He has taken his seat. It's been finished. He's able to rest, which is, if you remember all of our Levitical study, resting is the position of Sabbath, but more, even bigger, is the position of Jubilee, where you are completely in a receiving mode of grace. Jubilee is that picture of living completely in grace. So everything's done, and Jesus is there sitting there living completely in grace. In the gift of God's presence. So, in his adequacy, in his work, but also in his position. And this is actually so fun to watch this unfold here. Because first of all, it says that he is now seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Well, in Hebrews 1, we know that God had, the Father had promised Jesus, you sit at my right hand until I have all your enemies, right? He promised it in Psalm 110. So this is a promise that has been fulfilled. There's one here, one here.
We're being subtle.
Nope. So it's a fulfillment. The fact that he's seated at the Father's right hand is a fulfillment of the Father's promise. It also tells us that he is in the eternal realm, so that his position is in the eternal realm. That's a much better position than the Levitical priest had, which was not in the eternal realm. But this is the most fun thing. When during that time, the Sanhedrins were the ones who held court, and the Sanhedrins would have a judge, and then they would have two secretaries. One would be on the right hand of the judge, one would be on the left hand of the judge. And the secretary that sat on the left hand of the judge wrote only condemnations. You're guilty. The secretary that sat on the right hand of the judge wrote only acquittals. You are innocent. So when we see that Jesus is sitting at the right hand of the throne, we always think, oh, the right hand, that's the strength, yes. That's the place of honor, yes. But in this place, particularly, it's very important to understand that is the place of acquittal. So our high priest sits in the place of acquittal. And this is the only thing he gives out sitting at that place is the acquittals. Obviously, his position is a lot better than the Levitical priest, right? Because really, the Levitical priest never gave out acquittals. They never said, you're completely innocent. They said, basically, come back tomorrow, right? I mean, it was a very, very over and over kind of thing. So we see that we have a priest that is superior. This is just this big picture, a superior priest. He also has, Hebrews 8:1-6 will show us, that he has a lot of other pieces of his ministry that are superior. Not just his own work and who he is, but also his sanctuary, it tells us in 2. He ministers in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle. This is the place of rest and wholeness and truth. So not just the true, but truth. This is where truth is. And that's pretty cool if you connect it with the fact that he's sitting in the place of acquittal. That this is the place of truth. And that is something we need to understand because we live as if it's not true that we are acquitted. So many times. And yet the truth is we are. that's where our high priest is. He also, it says, going on in 3, that he has a better ministry. It says that, of course, the Levitical priests had to offer gifts and sacrifices, so obviously this priest does too. And yet his gift, his offerings, down in 6, are better. He also gives a better, has a better gift, in that it's a gift of grace that he's giving. And in the Levitical priests, the priest didn't give people gifts, right? They took them. And they said, you have to have this, I'm going to take this, so that I can give you a temporary relief of your sin. And yet his gift is that he gives, and you don't have to give anything back. And then it says in 6 again that he has a better covenant, promises that cannot be broken. They require no transaction whatsoever. And that's kind of what we're going to look at then, is that covenant that he has being so much better. So it says that he has a better covenant. We're just going to look quickly at why it had to be a better covenant, and then what a covenant is, what kinds of covenant there are, and how this covenant is so much better. So just 3 questions to ponder about: why did he have to have a different covenant? Why did he have to have a better one? Why couldn't he just have the same one and just make sure that that worked well? But since he was a whole and holy priest, then did he not need to have a covenant that actually changed hearts? Could a holy priest have a covenant that didn't change anything? If he had the same covenant, which changes nothing, then why have a different priest? And yet a better priest, a superior priest, must have a covenant that is able to change hearts. Could a priest who has finished his work minister from a covenant that finished nothing? And could a kingly priest in the eternal realm be limited by a covenant that made nothing perfect, whole, and eternal? It would be ridiculous. It would be worthless to have this priest who's in the eternal doing something that doesn't make things eternal, brought back to wholeness. So he has to have a different covenant. He has to have a better covenant than what we see the Levitical priests ministering from. So a superior priest in the eternal realm must have a superior covenant in order for his ministry to be effective. Otherwise, there's no use for him coming in. So what's a covenant? Without looking at it, how many of you can tell me the definition of a covenant? Okay.
Accompanied by signs and sacrifices and
solemn oaths. Good, very good. Obviously, Kristen knows it well because she's been able to teach it. So, a covenant, how many of those have never, ever studied covenant? Just so I know. 1, 2, 3. Okay. So, a covenant, and this is outside of religion, inside of religion, all through history. This is true. So this is not just a religious thing. This is a truth that has been throughout. Obviously, God ordained this so they would understand. But a covenant, any covenant, is a solemn, which means serious, binding agreement. It's a legal agreement that people make. It's a solemn binding agreement, usually made by cutting animals in half and walking between the pieces. And that was both a sign and a sacrifice and a solemn oath, which covenants have in them. They may have different things to portray the signs and the sacrifices and the solemn oaths, but this is the big one that most people did. And they would say that they were cutting covenant. They didn't say they were making covenant. They would say they're cutting covenant. We say the same thing today. We just don't use the word covenant. We say, I cut a deal. That's where it comes from. Yeah. You cut a deal, it's the same as you cut a covenant. So, and it always refers to this ceremony of cutting animals and walking between the two of them. So we'll look at that in just a second. The ceremony of cutting two animals in half and walking between them was a picture, a sign of what it would look like, the whole working out of a covenant and what would look like if the covenant was broken. It was also a sacrifice. It was an indication that the parties in the covenant understood that there was something to give up, a loss. So no matter what kind of a covenant you make, there is something that you actually give up. It's either you give up some control, because if you're dealing with someone else and you're making an agreement, you're giving up some of your control, right? Or you're giving up some of your independence. So it was this picture that you're giving up something, that there is a sacrifice in making an agreement with someone. But also in the big picture of that walking between the pieces of flesh is that it's an oath. And the oath is saying, if I am so serious about this covenant, I so intend to keep this agreement with you, that if I break it, may the same thing that happened to these animals happen to me. That was the agreement you were making. And that's why in the old times that they would do this, that they would actually cut the animals and they would walk through the pieces to say, look, this is how serious I am about making this agreement. And so we have so many practices handed down to us about covenant that we don't even realize it actually is a picture of this. So we know often that we've done this, and I won't go through this all, but I think one of the prettiest things in marriage, in a wedding ceremony, is this picture. And what is that that we do in a wedding ceremony that pictures us walking between the pieces?
Going down the family aisle.
Right. Yep. It's why the family is seated on, the bride's seat is on this side, the groom's on this side, and you walk between the pieces of the two families to say, this covenant I am so serious about that may happen to me a breaking of family if I break this covenant. So there's lots and lots. If when you want to study covenant again, you will learn all of those things. But all this to say that a covenant is a binding, very serious agreement. In fact, it is the most binding agreement that we find in all of history, is a covenant, when people make a covenant or enter into a covenant. The interesting thing that missionaries find over and over and over again is when they go into a tribe or a nation that has not had any contact with the outside world, and they begin to teach, particularly if they begin to teach scripture from sin on, they don't get it. If they teach from Genesis 1 on, they get it, and they say, well, we have a ceremony that talks about that, and they have a covenant ceremony. And they find this over and over and over again through all sorts of different peoples around the world, that this is just been in the culture since the very beginning. So God again uses this too. And what we see is, we talked about Melchizedek and being connected with Abraham's promise. The very thing that happens right after the Melchizedek introduction is that God actually does this ceremony. And so we have in chapter 15 of Genesis the ceremony of God having Abram cut the pieces, and then there is this ceremony of something walking through the pieces, and it's not Abraham. So that's just a real broad idea of what the covenant looked like when people would make these agreements. What was the purpose of any covenant? Anybody remember? What's the purpose of a covenant? Right. So redeem from death and equip for life. It's always to take away some kind of a death and bring some kind of a life. So any kind of agreement that's made in the covenant, the purpose is, look, if we don't make this agreement, there will be some kind of a death. So a covenant where Abraham and some other foreigner came and they would make a covenant about whose land was whose, they were protecting, look, if we don't make an agreement, you're going to trespass on my land and there's going to be some kind of a death, right? I'm going to lose or you're going to lose. And we're also going to equip for life so that we can live peacefully, so that we avoid that death. So all covenants, the purpose of a covenant is to redeem from death and equipped for life. There are two kinds of covenants, and this is where we always lose our ideas. And again, just like the Hebrew Christians here, we are so immersed in a transactional living that when we see covenant, we know we're in covenant, we forget which kind of covenant we're in. So there are two kinds. One is conditional, one is unconditional. A conditional covenant is made by two parties for the sake of protecting each individual. So each individual wants to be protected, and so they come and they make an agreement. And it is received by agreement, by both parties saying, yes, I will do this, and yes, you will do this. It is, you build me this, I will pay you this. So each party has a responsibility in there. And the basis then is fear. The basis is, I am afraid that you might trespass on me. I'm afraid that if I build this for you, that you might not give me what's fair for me building. I'm afraid of that. So let's make an agreement that makes sure that we both say, if I build this for you, you will pay me. Right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. What does that sound like?
A transaction.
Of course, it's a transaction. So covenants can be transactions if they are a conditional covenant, which is the most common one that we're used to. We make them all the time, even if we don't call them that. In legal terms, we mainly call it a contract. A contract is a conditional covenant. We actually used to call them covenants. Sometimes we still do call them covenants. There's covenants in neighborhoods, right? Neighborhood covenants, things like that. Basically is, because it's based in fear, I am afraid that you might step on my part. So I am going to protect from death. I'm going to protect from me losing something. And I'm going to make sure that I get what I want. I'm going to make sure I get life. So again, it's, even though it's conditional, the purpose is still to redeem from death and to equip for life. Does that make sense?
Reminds me of a prenup.
That's what I was thinking.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely, absolutely.
That's all based out of fear.
Right, exactly.
Instead of giving it away.
Exactly, exactly. Which is why we make conditional covenants, is we're so afraid that we're not going to get what's fair. Mm-hmm. And what we've already learned in Leviticus is, do we really want fair?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we want more than fair. So that is a conditional covenant called a contract most of the time. There is also an unconditional contract or unconditional covenant. And that is usually made by one party for the sake of another. In other words, in an unconditional contract, someone says, I so much want you to have something good that I will do anything for it. And I don't care. I'm not even looking for something good out of it for myself. That is an unconditional covenant. So that it's based on one party's desire to give rather than two parties afraid that they're not going to get what they want. That is an unconditional covenant. It is received by relationship rather than by agreement. And it is based on love rather than fear. And we mostly call that kind of a covenant a will. That's an unconditional covenant that one party has made a legal binding agreement, really with himself, I will give good to someone else. Now it begs the question, well then what kind of a covenant is marriage? And this is where we always like, well, it's two parties. Yep, it is two parties. It's two parties though, each giving their own covenant. I'm giving you a covenant that says, I will give you my life for your good. Doesn't matter what you give me. And this is where we always lose it. Because the agreement is not, I will be by you sickness and in health, rich or poor, if you stand by me, sickness, health, rich, right? It's not that. It's I will stand by you, rich or poor, sickness and health. I'm giving you a covenant. It is two people giving two covenants. made into one. They look like one. So that is an unconditional covenant marriage. So these are the two kinds of covenants there are. We are most familiar with the conditional covenant, and even with an unconditional covenant like marriage, I have been to weddings where the pastor has said, now this is a 50-50 deal. No. If it is, it is a conditional covenant. Unconditional covenant. There are only two kinds. It's conditional or unconditional. If you go into marriage saying it is a conditional covenant, then have you really made a marriage? According to what God says, a marriage is to reflect who He is. It's not. So for you to ever in your marriage say, well, if He does this, then I can do this. Right? Anytime we say that, we've stepped into a conditional covenant. So, and it's important for us to understand that because of how we live and also how we take God's covenant that He's given us. Because we do the same thing. We have this unconditional covenant and we step back and go, let's play it like it's a conditional covenant.
But without knowing or understanding covenant in the first place, it has become a contract.
Absolutely has.
Even though God ordained it to be covenant.
Right.
It has become a contract.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there a mention of a covenant in the new earth, of a covenant to each other and not just in marriage?
Well, that's what we'll get to from this whole lesson, is that the covenant that we've been given is a covenant that we actually give to as well. So yes, I would say that's the simple answer. We'll get there. All right, does that make sense? That's as much as we're going to go over covenant, but hopefully that gives us an idea and a base for what we're looking at Jesus offering us, this new covenant. So what I'd like to do is connect the covenants, the old and the new, and contrast them and look at the difference between the two. So the old covenant, which is the first covenant, the law, the Ten Commandments, that which was attached to the Levitical priesthood. That's what we're talking about when we say Old Covenant. This too was inaugurated with the same kind of ceremony. So I think she had you look at how it was inaugurated, right? Mm-hmm. And we have this place where, interestingly enough, where it's inaugurated is in between two mountains. So it actually looks like it's in between the split of two things. But what do we have Moses doing? He takes blood, right? And what does he do with the blood? Yeah. He sprinkles it on the altar and the book of the covenant and the people. So it's that show of, obviously, where did he get the blood? He cut animals in half. And he sprinkled them on both to say, you have entered a covenant. So we know that it was entered the exact same way as we see a normal covenant being entered. So what we do know, and now we're getting into 8 again, pick up at verse 6. But now he's obtained a more excellent ministry, by as much as he's also the mediator of a better covenant, which has been enacted on better promises. So if the new covenant is a better covenant, then this covenant, old covenant, is a lesser covenant. It doesn't mean that it wasn't a covenant. It doesn't even mean that it wasn't a good covenant. It means that it was less. It wasn't as effective. So when we talk about old and new, be very careful that we don't talk about age, but lesser and better, really. Verse 7, for if that covenant had been faultless, so in other words, the old covenant was faulty. It was not faultless, but faulty. It could not bring life. The law itself never brought life. Talk about that as we talk about the next piece. Because it says after that in 8, for finding fault with them, the Jews, the people who were in the old covenant, In other words, what it's saying is the old covenant was not just faulty, but it was a fault finder. It was a measuring stick, right? Thus, we have all these measuring tools. A measuring stick is to see how much you match up, right? Somebody, I think it was, I don't remember which one over here, talked about why do we use measuring things? To see where I'm off, right? Oh, you said, yeah, to see. Mm-hmm. So I use a watch to see just how behind I am, right? Mm-hmm. Or we can flip it on the other side to see how I can make everything fit so it is right, right? Mm-hmm. This is what the law is. It's a measuring stick. It never changes, and it's you trying to match it all the time. So if you're always trying to match it, it then serves as a fault finder. It serves as a way to show you where you're off, where you're wrong, where you don't match up. That's what the law was.
Or where you're ahead.
Or where you're ahead. How many of you match and you're ahead? And we feel really good about that, right? If we're using our watch as a measuring stick and we go, wow, I got three things done in the time I thought I was going to get to, I am great. Right? Right? Isn't that how we feel? And we think, this is good. The calendar, we use that. Or for me, and remember this happened with the biking thing. Last year we did the biking thing. And I'm going to do 500 miles. This is my goal. And every day I'm out there and I'm doing it. And I'm close. I'm like, maybe 20 miles away. 20 miles. I'm thinking, yes, the battery goes out. I lose all idea of where I'm at. Oh, no. And I'm all flustered. And, of course, God starts speaking to me. And so why would it be so good that you matched a goal that you made to go 500 miles? You're matching something that's static. But that's what the law is, that picture of being a measuring stick. Where are you? Do you match up?
I feel like we use it mostly, where do you match up to the person next to you?
Mm-hmm. Measuring stick, you mean?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, or like just, it's always in relation to, like, me either ahead or behind.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, you think about business world and how they're always trying to match their profit.
Right. Right. And it's never good enough anymore to... I'm going to match what I did last year. No, now I need to do better.
Yeah.
And so if I'm matching myself with anything, if I'm a business world, I'm matching my profits, I match them with what I did last year, or I match them with another company. We do the same thing.
They have that term, profit matching.
Well, yeah, of course.
It's for like your retirement account. They're going to profit
right.
100% of what you put in or 25%
right.
of what you put in.
Right, right. And we always want to be better, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we match with one another, we're never content to go, oh, yeah, I got the same. We feel much better. I did a little better.
Mm-hmm. And we're using things not intended to be
right.
measuring things like a house or
I
car
was just
right.
clothes,
yes.
account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like things that aren't
yep.
like even
yeah.
meant to be
yep.
points of measurement.
Right, exactly.
And that's where power comes from then.
Yes.
Pride.
Perceived.
Yes. Right, right,
yeah.
right, exactly.
Or,
right.
I mean, but you think about like, Nazi Germany, and their power came because they thought they were ahead, but also because the Jews thought it was a mentality that they were
right.
You know, it's like a
yeah.
power made up power, but it works.
But it,
mm-hmm.
but that's what we work on,
yeah.
right? Right. The companies who have the better profits are more powerful,
mm-hmm.
right?
And I
so
think we teach our children too because
yes.
we say, look how tall you are.
Yeah.
Are you one of the tallest in your class? Great, but you're so tall.
Do you like basketball?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And you think of, like, if you put all our husbands in the room, who cares who's the tallest?
Right,
really.
Right, exactly.
We don't care.
Exactly.
We don't care when they're fine.
Yeah, yeah. Right, right. And that's kind of why I wanted these visuals of all these measuring tools, how much we do it
yeah.
over and over and over again to make sure it's right. To make sure we are okay. This is what the law was. And almost always, the law reminded us We're not okay.
It takes us out of God's rhythm, I think, because we're always trying to measure the time, measure the day, measure did I do enough of these in 1 week?
Yes, yes.
And that removes us from, puts us in our rhythm.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And if you think about the amount of time that things are actually on target, it's like 1% of your whole life.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, Jill, I think of working with a trainer, and it's not so much the weight, but the inches.
Mm-hmm.
The post and pre and post measurement.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Very true.
I'm conflicted right now because we just put our house on the market.
Uh-huh.
And I just laid down the law at our house. The house will look this way all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what did you just call that?
The law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And is it, Rebecca, let me ask you this. Is it giving you life? You can't see your mom.
No. But it's how it has to be.
Ah, okay.
But I don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like I don't like it.
Yeah.
But I feel like it has a meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So much we can continue on. Let's go through that because I think I want to be able to, for us to work through this a little bit more. So the law is a fault finder. Verse 9, it talks about that this new covenant will not be like the old covenant, which I made with their fathers the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and I did not care for them. Interesting right here. If we pair that with Exodus 24, basically what it's saying is that this covenant was made by agreement of two parties. This was a conditional covenant, this old covenant. Remember, when I made that covenant, he says, you said, in fact, this is what they say, all the words you have said, we will do that. Yes. And the words he said is, if you follow my commandments, you will live in the land. You will have no famine. You will have no sickness. We will do that. There were two agreements. The covenant was made by agreement of two parties that one would get what the other wanted, that they each would get what they wanted from each other. Okay? But 9 also tells us that they did not continue in my covenant, and therefore I did not care for them. What he's saying is, it was a conditional covenant, and one party broke the covenant, so I was no longer obligated to keep the covenant. That's what God's saying there. You broke the covenant, and therefore I could neglect you. That's where it says, I did not care for you. He's saying, I had no obligation then to care for you, because we made an agreement. And the agreement was, I will care for you if you do these. You broke it, covenant is no longer in effect. So, we also know from the Exodus point, and then from verse 10, this new covenant that I will make with the house of Israel, I will put my laws into their minds and I will write them upon their hearts. Where was the old covenant written?
On stone,
right? It was written on stone. It was visible. And it was external. Therefore, it was easily broken. In fact, how easily broken was it? It was still hot in Moses' hands. And all he needed to do was he had one fit of anger at seeing how they broke it. And all he did was throw it down. And it broke to pieces. Very easily broken when it is external. And here comes, I think, one of the most interesting pieces, verse 11. And they shall not teach everyone his fellow citizen and everyone his brother, saying, know the Lord. That know there is to instruct with words in the hope of understanding more and more. So this covenant, this old covenant, needed to be taught with words in the hope that they would understand it more and more. In other words, it's as if I'm going to teach you dance lessons and I'm going to say, okay, everybody, this is what we're going to do. We're going to raise up our hand to the right. We're going to raise up our hand to the left. We're going to take our legs right, left, right, left. And I'm hoping if I just say it more and more that you're going to get it. Mm-hmm. It's as if I really, really, really wanted to do this time. and we went through this. I wanted to do a flash mob. Everybody know what a flash mob is? And I knew exactly the women I was going to choose to do it. And I knew that it would take more than just the, here's how you're going to do the dance. This is when you're going to do it, right? And if we just did it together, and that was it, just the five of us who are going to do the dance, that's how this law went. Look, this is just for you, and I'm going to tell you how to do it, and I hope you're going to understand it. It was a very static thing, right? We did this maybe a year ago. Remember with Annie? I gave somebody instructions to dance, just written out. And then I didn't give any instructions to Annie. I just gave her music, right? And what happens? They both danced, but one was full of life, and one was not. So this, where he says, you will no longer be like the old covenant, where it's words that you need to understand with the hopes of more and more understanding, that it's words that you teach. That's what the old covenant was. And it goes on for 12, then it says, for I will in this new covenant be merciful, and I will remember their sins no more, which was just the opposite of the old covenant. Because the old covenant said, if you do this, I will give you this blessing. If you do not do this, what will I do? Curse. I will give you curses. I will make sure that you leave the land. I will make sure that you are sick. I will make sure that you die. That was always the agreement there. And it seemed fair to them. Oh, all we have to do is this, and we'll get great life? Yeah, that's it. That's all. And yet they couldn't keep it. And so in the last verse of this, when he said a new covenant, he has made the first, the old one, obsolete. And obsolete actually means old. But whatever is becoming obsolete, old, is growing older. So here's the interesting thing, and I think we skip some words all the time. Who made the Old Testament old? What does it say? 13. When he said a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. He, God himself, made the old covenant old, obsolete, not useful anymore. He himself made it. So this isn't something we've thought about and said, we don't need it anymore. God himself said it is no longer needed. And it says it's growing old. It means it's continually aging and getting older and older and older. It will never stop being decrepit and therefore not being needed anymore. So the old covenant is a conditional agreement that relies on both parties to perform their duties. It teaches basically that a transactional, conditional way of life never grows holiness or wholeness. It never brings real life. It gives us this experience to understand that living outside of Eden will never progress to us being whole, ever. That was the point of the old covenant. So now we go back and look at the same verses and look at what it says for the new covenant, which was also inaugurated with the same ceremony. Where is that ceremony of flesh being cut in half and being walking between the pieces?
On the cross.
On the cross. And what was split in half?
The veil.
The veil was split in half, and Jesus himself, right? Because God forsakes him. And there was a splitting of God himself, which is one of those pieces that even to think about it for a moment is pretty amazing that he would do that to himself, which is the picture he gave Abraham when he instituted covenant in Genesis 15. We have him making Abraham split the pieces And then, what walks between the pieces in Genesis 15? God himself, the smoking fire pot and the flaming torch. God himself walks through pieces. To say to Abraham right then and preach the gospel right then, it is I who is making this covenant for you, and it is I who will take up the consequences for you breaking it. So that is how the new covenant was inaugurated, which is part of, is why it says, we now have confidence to enter the holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, which he inaugurated through the veil, that is his flesh. That's what that's talking about. So it is a greater promise than the old covenant, a greater covenant enacted on greater promises. It is effective, going to 7 and 8. For if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion sought for a second covenant, which will be faultless. For finding fault with them, he says, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will effect a new covenant. That word effect actually means to complete, to finish entirely, to give you a covenant that finishes the promise that I gave you in the very beginning, that will complete it. This is the kind of covenant that I'm giving you. This, again, is a gift. If it's a covenant that he effects, it doesn't say we will enter into a covenant together. We will enter into an agreement together. It says I will effect it. I will complete it. God himself does that. Therefore, it is a gift that he gives and an unconditional covenant that he gives. It is not made as a transaction. In 9, it says it's not going to be like that covenant where you didn't do your part, so I didn't have to do my part. It's not going to be like that. Verse 10, for this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days. I will put my laws into their minds and I will write them upon their hearts. So, as opposed to the old covenant, the conditional covenant being written on stone and external, being a measuring stick, here's what it looks like for you to come up to me. Can you come up to me? Keep measuring and measuring and you never measure up. The covenant I give you now is going to be inside, in a living part of you. It will be something living, which means it won't be external and it won't be static, which is very important for us because we like the static. We like the, we always say all the time, just tell me, God, just, I wish God would write down what he wants me to do and then I would do it, right? Which is external, something that can be measured and I can do it. We don't like the internal living thing because there's no specific black and white. Mm-hmm. It may look different.
I was talking about this the other day and had a neat realization that when you have black and white and do this, don't do that, it requires no conversation with God. And
absolutely.
You live in the gray,
yep.
You have to constantly be in conversation with them. But if we have just the this and that, then it doesn't require that.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's much easier. It requires no relationship. And in order to live inside, it means that my living it out and your living it out look different. Mm-hmm. And that, ooh, that's a little bit scary, right? Mm-hmm. That means I do have to rely always on that relationship rather than this static piece of paper. Mm-hmm. We do like static. And yet when we talk about it, do we want a static life? Do we want a life that doesn't change? No, absolutely not. So it's a funny thing that what we want is really not what we really want.
But to me, this is really so exciting. I don't know exactly how to explain it. Those guys said, oh, yeah, we'll do it.
Uh-huh.
But they really had no heart to do it.
No.
But God is giving us a heart.
Right, a heart to do it.
He's giving us an understanding. He's giving us a...
Yep.
By the Spirit, you can understand some of these things and how they're all related, and it makes you want to do
it.
It makes you want to try, even if it's hard.
Yeah, it is this power. Huge gift to be given something inside that changes. When I first started doing this lesson, I thought to myself, maybe I'll give everybody the choice. They could either have a videotape and a booklet, a record book, to keep to do exercises so that they can lose weight, or I can say I'm going to go with you and have surgery so you can have a new metabolism. Same thing, right? We have external, here's what you need to do and you will lose weight. Or I'll just give you a new metabolism. It's going to hurt. It's going to mean surgery for inside, but I'll give you a brand new metabolism. Thyroid works like crazy. Now, if that were true and I gave you a new thyroid and it's just working like crazy, would it mean that tomorrow you looked great? No, because you still have lots of stuff on you, right? Most of us, some of us. And it would take a while to get it off.
Yeah, I'm waiting for it to kick in.
So that's kind of this picture here is, I'll give you some external and see if you can match it. You can't. I mean, I don't care if I give you a DVD and you're the most A-type personality. You might do it for a while, but guess what? Then you get to be 40 and you get to be 50 and your mentality slows down, and I don't care if you do the same thing. You're not going to get the same results. But inside, this new heart that he gives us is alive. There's an intrinsic ability to do something that you weren't able to do beforehand.
Can I give an example? I have a really good friend that I talked to last night, and she and her husband and children got involved in a very cultish, legalistic organization. And when I went to visit her maybe a year or two ago, she was wearing like these long jumpers, no makeup, straight hair. And I said, do you, because she's a fashion designer, she's beautiful. I said, do you like this? She says, well, this is what Eddie wants me to do. And I went to the church with them, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is really legalistic. But didn't think much of, oh, and everybody in the church has 8 to 10 to 12 kids, okay? So I'm thinking to myself, they obviously don't believe in birth control, yada, yada, yada. And in my mind, I'm going, ah, scary. Didn't say anything to her because I didn't want to, you know, offend her because our friendship's kind of been, yeah, anyways. And so didn't really say anything to her, just thought, wow, gosh, this is really bad. They're getting into legalism. So she called me several weeks ago. And just last night, too, and she said, we finally got out of that church. She goes, it was all legalism. Mm-hmm. And we began to fall and follow, and we couldn't get out of it. I mean, our kids couldn't do an organized activity outside of the church because it would be bad influence. Now our kids are in everything, and they're under 10, and she has kids in everything. I mean, so they've swung way over to the, you know, not to the rebellion side, but to the other side, you know. But I was so thankful to God when she was talking to me last night for an hour about how they got out of it and how bad it was. I mean, now even her best friend is wearing something on her head that she got in the church. She says, we have nothing in common. If I tell her my kids are in basketball and in ballet, she'll just think, you know. So, I mean, this is just like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It definitely, what we find is, obviously, the law is very restraining.
Yeah.
And it's always an effort of striving to match it, with the new covenant. We have not only that it's written here, that it's alive in us, that it's actually got spirit in us, but here to me is the most fascinating thing. And if you don't start thinking about the words of Scripture, you won't see the nuggets that are here. So when we read 11, we already know, they shall not teach everyone his fellow citizen, everyone his brother, saying, know the Lord. That know, different know than the next one, is to understand by words that are taught. This know, this is really interesting, is to be able to see with physical eyes, to be acquainted with as a person. This talks about the incarnation of Jesus. The incarnation of God. It says this new covenant, you will be able to see with your eyes, and you will be acquainted with it as a person. It will be a person to you that you are able to see. The new covenant is so different than words on a page. It is living, breathing Jesus Christ, an entity that you are able to see with your physical eyes and actually experience the personhood of Jesus Christ. So, it's as if I had done that flash mob. And has anybody ever seen a real flash mob?
No.
Done? Do you know what a flash mob is?
No.
A flash mob is in the midst of just a regular, normal, everyday, crowded place, all of a sudden one person gets up and starts dancing and or singing. Another person gets up, and all of a sudden there's all these people, and you're not, if it's a good mob, you're not quite sure, ooh, can I join in? I mean, it's a good flash mob is one that says, I want to do that too. And you see the good ones that are like, yes, because it's all normal people. They all look different. They're doing different things. They might be doing the same step, but they look a little different. And they're all doing this, and it's exciting. And of course, I spent one whole day looking through all the flash mobs I could find that we could do together. And then I found a lot of really bad ones. And the bad ones are, not that they didn't do the steps right, the bad ones are, there's a scene in a mall, and there's an open space, and there's a people circle all the way around, just waiting and watching for something to happen. And then people come out, and they all have the same t-shirts on. And that's a performance. Mm-hmm. That's not a flash mob. Mm-hmm. The New Covenant says, this is real people, real, this is something real that you see. It doesn't feel performed. It doesn't feel like I'm separate from you. I'm in the midst of. So a performance, usually the law is performed, and often it's performed within a small group. We are all of the same. We all have the same t-shirts on. We all have our ponytails up in a little red bow. We all look the same. And if you see that happening in a mall, do you even have the desire to join it? Well, no, you don't, because you know, well, you're not a part of that. You don't have the t-shirt. Yeah. You're going to stick out.
Right. Can't have a
right. I can't have a ponytail.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, if you see a real flash mob, it's different people look completely differently. Some of them are really good at the dancing. Some of them are not. You, and there's this one clip I just want to show you so badly where the person was not involved in flash mob, but he sees it, and he's like, you know, you can see him. He's like, I want to join. Yeah, I want to join. It makes you just want, it just pulls you in. I can do this. Yeah, this will be fun. That's what the New Covenant should look like. It should be completely inviting and opening. I could fit in here because each person is different. I have some hope that I could actually fit into this.
Kind of like line dancing, thing where they're doing a line dance and you can run up and quickly follow and
right.
Join in.
Right, exactly, exactly. Period. Yeah, right, exactly. So we have this verse 11 where it is the new covenant will be physically seen, God incarnate being acquainted as a person. And then, of course, it says, in the new covenant, I will be merciful to their iniquities. I will remember their sins no more. Very different from the old covenant where if you failed your part, you were cursed. And he doesn't have anything part for us. I will forgive your sins and iniquities. I will forgive anything that you don't hold as covenantal. And we will talk about that more in the sacrifices because there are some really beautiful pictures of what that means to be forgiven. And then he says, this new covenant is new qualitatively, not age-wise, but it's different. It's a different kind of covenant. Therefore, it can give you something completely different. The new covenant doesn't just give you more of what the old covenant was. The new covenant gives you something completely different. It gives you something active rather than static. And active means it has lots of ways of being expressed rather than the static. Only one way matches with that. So what are the promises then of each covenant? The old covenant, and I'm kind of condensing them, but this is a good summary of each. The promises of the Old Covenant, which we get in Exodus 23 and 24, are that they would have plenty of food, that they would have no sicknesses from all the countries around them, they would have no barrenness like all the rest of the countries around them, they wouldn't have miscarriages, they would have a long life, their enemies would be battled by God himself, and they would live peacefully in the land. They would have all of these if they obeyed all the commandments. So these are pretty great promises, and they are conditional on whether they do it. And what happens, what you see there, is that the promises given are for peace, but they are peace in isolation. They are peace only in their little group. That's what the Old Covenant gives. So if you want to live in the Old Covenant, then it's all you're looking for is peace in your own little isolated place, which is really a lot of times what we do with our churches, right? We're going to do only the stuff within our church. We're only going to be here. We're going to be static and stay here, and it's really good and it's really comfortable. And I mean, there's great things that happen, and you enjoy it, but you're only here and you're isolated. That's all the Old Covenant can even give. The New Covenant, on the other hand, the promises, I couldn't even put all the promises of the New Covenant, but I categorized them. So from Jeremiah and from Ezekiel both, we know that we will have a heart transplant. We will be given, we will have our hard heart removed and have a new soft heart. Just like I talked about that metabolism, the thing that runs your body and that runs your life, that tells you really what is good, is going to be transplanted. Your spirit is transplanted. You will get His spirit to mesh with as one in your spirit, which is part of covenant. And that will bring us life. And from Ezekiel, you know that beautiful passage about Ezekiel, the dry bones? Yeah. We take that, oh, I hate it. We take that whole passage out of context because it's such a cool idea. There's these dry bones. It's in the midst of saying, this is what the new covenant will look like. The new covenant will look like, you are dry bones in the desert. You have no life in you. And I will come and breathe life into those bones.
How is it used out of context?
Because no one talks about that being that's the promise of the new covenant.
Okay.
That is, so there's the passage of Ezekiel goes from 36 and 37 and 38. This is what the new covenant will look like. And we often just talk about it as a really cool thing that, you know, here's a picture that God's saying, you know, is going to happen in Israel. What?
Or a neat song.
Or a neat song, yeah. But this is what the new covenant looks like. I'm going to give those dry bones breath, life. And what does that remind you of? Genesis, Eden. This is what I did in the very beginning. I gave you life. You were laying there and you were just dirt. But I put my breath in you. This is the new covenant. I put my breath again, ruach, spirit, pneuma, my spirit within you.
If you look at the Old Covenant, like plenty of food, no sickness, no barrenness, all of these things are the things that actually remove your hard heart and give you a soft heart.
Yes.
Like sickness and poverty and...
Right. Right.
Barrenness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which are, and we talk about the hard graces. What are they there for? To deconstruct so that you want the new covenant and the new heart.
And just to piggyback on that, I always found it interesting that God gave the law first. It wasn't something we made up.
Right.
So He gave it first purposely,
mm-hmm.
not so that we can measure up to it, to show that it was inadequate,
right.
and to give us that need.
Right. And desire. Yes. Right. Exactly. In the new covenant, we will get God's constant care. He will not turn away from us or stop doing good for us. Mm-hmm. In the old covenant, He was no longer obligated to do good for us. Mm-hmm. We will get restoration and mercy and be cleansed from uncleanness. And then, I think this is probably the coolest part of the New Covenant promises, is there will be justice and righteousness on earth. We've talked about this before. This is what Revelation pictures. Justice and righteousness on earth. Cities and waste places will be rebuilt. Desolate land will become like the Garden of Eden. And that's directly out of Ezekiel 36.
So don't we get right now, like these first heart transplants,
yep.
spirit transplant, constant care, and its restoration is the future of that?
Yep. Already beginning now. Yes, yes. So all of that is beginning and the process is continuing on. Cities will be filled with, and this is how it says, flocks of men. What it says is, you will return to the place where you will have one shepherd as your ruler, rather than all of you being your own. That's why it uses terms like there will be flocks of men, and the nations will know that it is the Lord who has restored. Instead of having peace in isolation, we will have peaceful community. It will be a flash mob, a real flash mob, that's dancing in the midst of a crowd, and you can't tell who's a part and who isn't, and everybody wants to be a part. And we see the picture in Revelation of everybody coming into that community, which restores what God originally intended, and that is a garden, but not a static garden, a garden that grows so much that it becomes a city full of flocks of men that is completely relational, that relationships grow. When he said, put Adam and Eve in the garden, he never intended to be just stay as a static garden, because he said to them, be fruitful and multiply. Make it bigger. Make it into a city under the shepherd. Make it into a city of flocks of men. That's what happens in the new covenant. So let me give you a full picture, though, because really there is another covenant that we've talked about, and that's the Abrahamic covenant. That's that original promise. So we need to understand that all of them are connected. Like Carol said, God put them in a certain order so that we would be able to understand and grow into that. And the Abrahamic covenant came first, and it was the promise. He promised to Abraham that there would be redemption from death and equipment for life. In reality, it's in Genesis 3 that he begins to promise this. He gives a glimpse of, here, I'm going to make a promise to you. I'm not going to let you stay in death. You've chosen it, but I'm not going to let you stay there. And to Abraham, he gives that promise. I will bless you to be a blessing. I will provide the seed that will ensure life, real life, life with me in that transformational eternity. I will ensure that you do not stay in death. Then he brings in the old covenant, and the old covenant is just a picture. He says it right to them. This is a picture. I'm picturing for you the fact that you have death in you. That's all you have in you. But life is in me. And I'm going to, in that, prepare the soil, like Carol said, prepare you so that you're willing to be a soil that receives it. I'm going to till you and deconstruct you so that you understand I'm looking all over that dirt, and there is nothing in there but weeds and death. I'm going to prepare you with the old covenant. And then the new covenant provides that actual redemption from death and equips for life by planting the seed within us, his own spirit of Christ, which takes away our barrenness and replaces it with his abundant life. Now, I want to do an activity with you so that we have a much more vivid living idea of what this looks like. So I want you to put all your stuff down. And should I say, you probably will not like this activity. So, how many do I have? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, so the person next to you is going to be your partner. I'm going to give you each a tape measure and a little card. So go ahead and just take a card and pass them around.
The trainer thing.
So you are, yes, you each need a card. You are going to have your partner measure your bust, measure your waist, and measure your hips. You are to write their name big up on top and write their measurements down. So I'd like you to do that. So each partner will get one. What? What'd you say? So Betty, go with Kim. You have a measuring tape. So you and Julie, Julia. Robin, you and Natalie. Annie, you and Melanie. Oh, that's you. Karen, you and Pat. Jeannie, you and Kim.
I'll start with you.
and you Peggy. Okay?
We need a
measure. Oh, you need a measure. Here they go. Everybody have one? Do you guys, have one?
You need to start on the right hand.
They should be coming around. Here they are.
Oh, there we go.
Okay. When they're done, use, or whoever's done with their tape measure first, we have one more group that needs a tape measure.
You should have to start there.
You have to start in the middle. All right.
Get to know each other. Measure you.
Nobody has to measure me. That's the privilege of being a teacher.
37 and a half.
Yeah. Definitely have some boobs.
I definitely do.
But they have to go with it. See? Yeah. So
it's the widest part. Yeah.
No,
so just so you know, hey girls, your hips are the widest part, the biggest part of your whole body. So it's the biggest part of your behind, all the way around. Yep.
Okay, Jill. Yeah. I don't know who this one is, but the one is in the middle.
Yeah.
Do you know why that is?
And then the hips are like right
here. Yeah.
With the big
part. I have no idea. That's interesting. That's interesting.
Is there a video on yourself? I thought it wasn't. I thought it was.
Everybody's had it. When you're done with the measuring devices, you can put them down.
I hope you're undressing first.
Yeah.
Judy actually done that.
Well, you could have.
We just did it with all our sweaters on.
My pants
are pinched.
Have you?
Yes.
Okay.
You can't tell.
That's a good thing.
Okay, as soon as you're done, put your measuring tape here.
Okay.
I'm the teacher. I don't have to get measured.
Same way we do. One leg at a time.
Oh, I put them on twice. Two at a time.
Hey, I'll give you what?
Good grief.
39.
There's a one over there. Oh, this is going to be... The tape is big enough?
Oh, gosh.
23. Yeah. I have some of their 39. Many of your pictures. Oh, yeah, I know. Boyfriend. Yeah. He dragged me down.
Okay. Ladies. Okay, girls. Now, you have a choice. You have a choice. You can hand in your records, and I will keep them in a thing, and we will continue to measure you off and on through the semester.
I thought we're learning about not being under law.
Or you can choose that. Or you can choose to have your partner come and take a candle and burn it. No. Uh-oh. Okay. There we go. No. You're going to burn it in the fireplace.
Okay.
Where the leg of our lambs are still sitting there.
The flowers are beautiful.
Yes, they are.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Admiring those.
Are they beautiful?
Yes.
Aww. Yeah, they're so nice. I got a little. Okay. That is gorgeous, too.
Yeah. That is
beautiful.
But you should.
No, that's from Cornell.
That's from Cornell.
He should. Yeah,
so, how many of you would like me to keep them in a file? Anybody?
I have someone in my life doing that.
We will keep on measuring you over and over again.
I do, please.
You want me to keep it in a file?
Yeah.
Okay.
It'll be fun.
If you want your partner to measure, give it to your partner and then have her come up and burn it. And you can give. Let's have maybe four at a time. And I want it burnt completely.
Yeah.
Go ahead, take one in.
Mortifying.
Is this all right?
Yep.
Oh, man. Humbling.
There we go. That should be good. Okay.
I said I don't really care either way, to be honest.
But there are things that I would care.
Ah, measurements?
This one has the one.
So he made it.
That's interesting.
Well, he's doing great too, thank God.
Yeah.
Huh?
Now.
Thank
you.
Yes. Completely. I actually like that, yeah.
Your flu is open, I take it?
Probably not.
Your house is going to
fill. I mean, it's just little pieces. I did it last night over by the sink. It was fine. I was actually going to just have everybody do it here, and I thought, it might get dangerous.
Where would we put it?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I can see that. Oh, it's open a little bit.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, it does. Well, here's the sad thing. Those are scented candles, and I was hoping that it would be really pretty. And like, not quite.
Turning out, burning our junk isn't quite pretty.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's okay. I know I need to. I like to switch.
You put your head all in there, yeah.
I was like trying to.
Everybody done? Okay, girls, we're not done. I want us to get even a bigger impact of what that is like. So I want us to look at then, we've been talking about Jesus being a different kind of priest, an anti-establishment priest, a priest who wants to retell your story. And if he is therefore also the new covenant himself, he is the new covenant incarnate, then let's go back and see what Jesus looked like when he was giving us glimpses of what the new covenant would look like. And we talked about this when he was walking around really showing just the opposite of what the Levitical priests were doing. What were the kinds of things he was doing as the incarnate covenant? He always, first of all, remained connected to the Father. Mm-hmm. And in that, he was able to go out to the people. Remember the difference? Mm-hmm. The Levitical priests all said, come to me, come to me. And he went out to the people. So if he's the incarnate covenant, then the incarnate covenant actually goes out to people. It doesn't call them in. He related personally with outcasts, unclean people, and sinners. This is who he actually had relationships with. It wasn't, who, you're a sinner, you're a prostitute, you're a tax collector, you don't fit the measuring stick. He went out to them and didn't just go, oh, hey, here you go, here it is, and leave. This is why they have portrayed all these times where he's called a lover of drunkards, because he actually partied with them. Mm-hmm. He actually related with them. He didn't just go out and then go back in. There was relationship with them. And it says the covenant will be able to be seen with your eyes, and it will be a relationship rather than a static thing. He offered wholeness and forgiveness without holding on to debt. You remember the woman caught in adultery? He said, I condemn you. I don't condemn you at all. Just go. Don't sin anymore. Here's a choice. He didn't say, okay, now I'm going to give you some ways that you can, you know, avoid doing this again. He just said, go and sin no more. I'm giving you freedom to choose now. Always with the new covenant, you will see this choice. It's always a freedom, a choice for freedom. Never where the law is a restriction, not freedom. He lived a life of the celebration of Jubilee rest. We see that when he was picking the wheat on Sabbath and saying, I'm receiving grace. This is all God gave me. I am actually celebrating Sabbath better than you, because I'm receiving what God has given me as grace, not something that I have done. And he always confronted transactional living. And where do we see that best? But in the cleansing of the temple. They were there about transactional living. He therefore, as the incarnational covenant, was a gift rather than a measuring stick. He did not go out with the law and say, well, how do you measure up? He went out and offered them choice and freedom and forgiveness and not holding on to their debt at all. It says in John that truth and grace were finally realized in Christ. They were finally manifested in person with Jesus. So this is what we saw him doing in his life as this glimpse of what the new covenant actually looked like. He embodied that completely. So the new covenant, therefore, engages people where they're at, gives them freedom to choose, and doesn't say, if you don't choose it, I can't relate to you. But he gives them this offering of friendship and relationship and life. And I'm not going to remember your debt. I'm not going to hold on to your debt. Here's a question for you. All of the things that you burnt, do you remember your partner's measurements?
No,
you don't. That's what the new covenant looks like. Forgiveness means he doesn't remember them. He will never bring them up again. And I can hopefully pretty much guarantee that not one of you will come back next week and say, so your measurement is 43.
How did you know?
So, which one did you enjoy more? Having somebody measure you or having somebody burn your measurements?
Burn,
obviously. Well, here's the interesting thing. If the new covenant will be seen physically in relationship, and Jesus is not here physically relating, where is the new covenant now?
In us.
In us. We are the incarnational new covenant. It is physically seen and encountered in us as a person. We as his body physically embody the new covenant. So the question is, are you a measuring stick or are you a gift? Do you like the old covenant so much that you measure others? Or do you enjoy the new covenant so much that that's what you're able to give? We can only give out what we receive. And really the question is, do you really receive the new covenant every day? And the indication is, if you're only giving out old covenant, if you're only measuring and measuring and measuring, there's not much new covenant going in. It really is a question is, do you really want to be measured? Because God says, I'll give you that choice. You can choose to be measured, and you can choose for me to keep it as a record. But then that's how you will be. That's your choice. You chose old covenant. You chose to stay being measured all the time. You want me to put it in the file so that I can bring it out and say you didn't make it? Or do you want new covenant? Do you want to receive grace every day? Do you want to receive the fact that he burns it every day? He never remembers it. He never brings it up again. I will not be able to take those pieces and put them back together. When you leave, I will not be able to go, ooh, now I can list them. I won't be able to do that. That's what the new covenant is. That's how much of a gift it is. And it's that much of a gift that if it's real and you've really received it, then it is what we begin to give out. And it looks different in each of us as we give it out. It looks different. But what we give out is freedom and not measurement. And I think that is something solemn enough for us to think about, how often we measure. That's why I think it's an amazing thing to see how much we measure just normal things. None of us likes to be measured in everything. Now, maybe some of you didn't mind your measurements, and that wasn't a big thing. But I can pretty much guarantee you there is something in your life you don't want anyone else to measure. Right?
You know, one of the hard things evaluations every year.
Mm-hmm.
And when I worked at the Arboretum, my supervisor would call me in every year. And I hated all that. It was terrible.
Yes. Yeah.
It really was.
Yep. Yep. And the new comment says, I will never call you in and evaluate you.
Yeah.
I love you, and I'm giving the gift to you. And it's just receiving that. But so many times we want the measurement. How am I doing, God? I'm doing great. I am involved in every ministry, and I give to the poor, and I do this. And we measure ourselves. And we make that measurement stay in there. It's a gift celebration. When I think of the flash mobs, that's what I think about our lives should look like. New covenant should be exuberant. Wow, I've got this. It's so cool. I cannot stop dancing. The flash mob was an idea because of the sermon from our church this Sunday. They did that. In the midst of a sermon, all of a sudden, the flash mob. Now, we're sitting in here listening to it, and it's a Michael Jackson song. And I'm telling you, I got up and started dancing. It was one of those, I want you back. I could not, I mean, it was so enticing. Like, I don't want to sit and listen. I don't want to go, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, even if I were in the midst of everybody, I would be moving. That's what the new covenant should be looking like in us. That it's inviting, and we want people to come, and we don't want them to look like me.
Yeah.
I want you to express the new covenant within you, not get the t-shirt that we all have. So, at some point, I will bring those candles back and or the measuring sticks back. And hopefully, we'll remember that the new covenant has no measuring sticks in it. There are none of those in the new covenant. That is something to celebrate and receive. And this is what he's talking about when he talks about grace. Is that not grace? Is not the light of that fire grace? Is not, and these candles were scented, but I smell other stuff. Is that not grace? It's what, when we get into the tabernacle next week, we're going to talk about the incense. The smell is a delight to the Father.
That's what it smells like, the Orthodox churches.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have all that incense. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of remembering. He does not remember them anymore. It's a beautiful aroma for us to receive grace. So, Father, we want to be people who are receivers. Receivers of grace every single day. That you burn up our measurements, all kinds of measurements. And that they are no longer remembered. And that we are received as your precious daughter each and every day. May we, Lord, take that in so much that we are dancing in the streets, inviting others, not by word of mouth, but by the fact that we have said God is good in all things, and that they might see your goodness and desire it too. You are absolutely God-filled goodness and grace for us every day. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Happy birthday.